It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a pediatrician answers your questions about the COVID vaccines for infants and kids under five. First, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its fourth hearing yesterday. The group focused on how former President Trump pressured state and local officials to reject the results of the 2020 election and in some cases submit unofficial slates of pro-Trump electors in states that had been won by Joe Biden. One piece of new evidence yesterday involves Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Text messages show Johnson's staff asked the vice president's team on January 6th if he could hand over a list of alternate electors for Michigan and Wisconsin. Vice President Pence's staff refused. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's covered this and is here to get us caught up. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you remind us of what these false slates of electors were and why we had one here in Wisconsin?
Well, this was part of a legal strategy at first by the Trump campaign. Some of the electors had said that the idea was, as court challenges, seeking, like in Wisconsin, to throw out certain amounts of absentee ballots or what have you, as those were working their way through the courts, the idea was that having these alternate electors would help, if the cases were won, then they would be, they could be submitted to Congress and potentially be chosen in lieu of the Democratic elector votes for Joe Biden. So this was in multiple swing states. Wisconsin was one of them. And that's essentially what I understand about the process.
The court cases didn't overturn those election results, but those documents signed by electors didn't go away, at least according to this exchange. Can you remind us what this exchange between a Senator Johnson staff or his chief of staff as of that day and the vice president's staff? What did we learn in this exchange?
So there was a screenshot presented by the committee during the hearing, and it really jumped out at me. I'm looking for a Wisconsin connection to all of this, knowing that we had these alternate electors or fake electors as the committee has described them. But essentially, Johnson's chief of staff, Chris Hodgson, reached out, I'm sorry, Senate Sean Riley, mm-hmm. Johnson's chief of staff, reached out to Chris Hodgson, who's an aide for Mike Pence. And this was like right before the attack on the Capitol and right before the electors were going to be certified by Congress and by Pence. And Riley basically asked, he said, Johnson needs to hand something to V. POTUS. And when Hodgson asked what it was, Riley responded, alternate slate of electors from Michigan and Wisconsin, because archivist didn't receive them. The archivist that he's talking about is the, the National Archives, which they were also sent to. And Pence's aide Hodgson told him, do not give that to him. So it makes it look like Senator Johnson was willing to hand those to Mike Pence, right before the actual certification process was about to begin.
Johnson's office responded saying it's not a story, basically. Reporters talked to Senator Johnson outside the Capitol yesterday, asked him about it. Here's a listen to that exchange with Manu Raju of CNN.
This was a staff-to-staff exchange, and I was, basically unaware of it. And the chief staff contacted the vice president's staff, said, do you want this? They said no, and we didn't deliver it, and that's the end of the story.
But why was he even asking for that?
Because somebody delivered this to our office and asked to deliver that to the vice president.
Did you support his efforts to try to get those slates to the vice president?
No, I had no knowledge of this.
So what questions are people still trying to resolve here, Rich, about this situation?
Well, there are still questions about whether Senator Johnson was involved with it or not, because the text seems to indicate that Johnson indicated he wanted to hand this to the vice president. So that's one question. There's a lot of questions about who, dropped this manila envelope off at the senator's office. Some folks are implying that Johnson was involved with receiving them as well. Like, he was knowledgeable. And then also there, some of the other testimony and documents that were revealed by the committee yesterday showed that if people with Trump's campaign were asking some of these alternate electors in Wisconsin to fly this over, you know, on the on January 4th, just a couple days before the certification was set to go down. And so there was a concerted effort, and who brought the the slate of alternate electors and the votes and all the documents to Johnson's office, or whether he brought them himself, you know, it's unknown.
Rich, we'll keep watching for coverage on this. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter. He talked to us about news from yesterday's Congressional House hearing that Senator Ron Johnson's staff asked to pass a slate of false presidential electors to the vice president on January 6th, 2021. Now, earlier this month, an engineer at Google went public with concerns he raised about one of the company's language models starting to think it was alive. The company looked into his claims and dismissed them and ultimately placed him on administrative leave. Other computer science experts have reviewed the transcripts and agreed the model is not sentient, but it is leading the industry to have wider conversations about the morals and ethics of technology that might border someday on consciousness, as well as algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about artificial intelligence? Have you heard about this story, about this Google engineer raising these concerns? What do you think? Where do you draw the line between a computer program and a living thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. He's the associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He earned his PhD at UW-Madison. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start with this story. People may have seen it in the news. Initially, some people maybe got excited or worried. What do you make of this claim from this Google engineer?
Like Google and many other people, I think it pretty implausible that this particular technology is sentient, if we mean by that something like conscious or capable of feelings or understanding or having a sort of inner mental life. Maybe it's intelligent in some sense. That's a pretty broad term, but I think it pretty unlikely that it meets the bar for sentience.
Let's talk about a few terms here. Artificial intelligence, we go to a lot. I think it might mean different things to different people. How do you broad strokes define it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I don't think there's a single definition that's accepted. People use it in different ways, but broadly it means artificial systems that can engage in behavior that we recognize as intelligent in some sense. It can solve a problem in a way that we broadly see as intelligent or human. And that means lots of different things, because there's lots of different kinds of intelligences that we recognize. Most of today's artificial intelligence comes in the form of machine learning, which is algorithms that are trained on lots and lots of data, and so they can accomplish really intelligent tasks on the basis of that training.
And a lot of these machine learning things do things that are meant to resemble creativity, art, or writing something, or in this Google engineer's case, having a conversation with a human. Can you talk about how that works if I'm sitting down and maybe having a typed conversation with this machine learning thing that talks a little like people?
Yeah, sure. So imagine that the way I train this algorithm is I just gave it tons and tons of text. So it's read Shakespeare and Jane Austen and science journals and what people have said on the internet, and it's learned when people say things like, hi, how are you doing? It should reply from some list of things like, oh, I'm good, how are you? Or something like that. And so if you train it on enough data, it can get pretty good at having a conversation with you. I mean, this kind of programming has been going on for a long time. There's a famous thing called the Turing test. Alan Turing sort of thought the way to understand intelligence was if you could have someone have a conversation with someone behind a screen and they couldn't tell whether it was a computer or a human, then that's the Turing test. That would count as intelligent. And we're getting closer and closer, or it seems, to things that can pass that kind of test, where you could have a conversation with them and you might not be able to tell that you're talking to a machine. Now, most instances we can tell, you get on a chatbot online to get some help for some services you have, or some, you go on a cancel service and you're talking to a chatbot and you can tell that it's not quite human. But we're getting further and further along, and Lambda seems to be like that.
Lambda is the Google product we're talking about here. Now, if we're trying to define artificial intelligence as having some kind of, I don't know, consciousness or self-awareness. It seems like part of the problem is we don't necessarily know how to define that for a biological creature like a human.
Yeah, we have a real difficult time saying exactly what it is. Like, we know what it is because it's happening to us all the time. And we also have a real hard time figuring out what the basis for it is. Like, what can a system made of silicon even have that kind of state? Like, this is a serious debate at the sort of foundations of philosophy and cognitive science about what grounds consciousness. Like, what exactly can give rise to this thing that we can barely describe?
We're talking to Northeastern University philosophy professor John Basil about the morals and ethics of artificial intelligence and algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes for artificial intelligence? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about it? And how about these big data things that might affect a lot of decisions in our lives, like whether we get a mortgage, a job, a prison sentence? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with John Basil, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Northeastern University, with us today to talk about the prospect of sentient artificial intelligence and how it would fit into our moral and ethical systems. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question, a thought about artificial intelligence, what it is, do you have worries about what it could mean for us humans and about how we treat it if and when we have an artificial intelligence that we agree, yeah, is somehow equivalent to a form of consciousness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John, part of the reason, as I understand it, that this Google engineer brought up these concerns about Lambda is he was worried not about how an artificial intelligence will treat humans, but about how we treat it. What are the ethics? What are our responsibilities to something like this that we've created? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is the part, while I don't think that this system rose to the level of sentience, right, I do think we are ill prepared for that possibility. We don't have the greatest track record of treating individuals of other species well. It took a long time, for example, to get oversight boards to govern animal subjects research to make sure animals weren't being harmed unnecessarily. And the real risk, I think, is given that we have a hard time saying what consciousness is and how it arises, there's a real risk that if we created a sentient AI, we might not be able to tell that we've done so. We might not be able to figure out what would be good or bad for it. We might be totally ignoring what would make its life go well or poorly, or make it suffer or benefit. Might just shut it off. And so I think that there, given the hype there is behind AI, there's a real risk that we don't have measures in place to ensure that we avoid unethical treatment if that thing were to arise. Now, when will that arise? I don't know, but we're not well prepared for that circumstance.
Now, that's a hypothetical that we're not prepared for. Another issue I know you're concerned about is something that is here and happening now, the use of big data and algorithms to crunch through that data to figure out a lot of stuff that affects our lives. I mentioned a few moments ago that might include getting a mortgage or a job or determine a prison sentence in part. What kind of concerns do you have about the way those tools are used?
Oh man, we only have like 10 minutes, right? it's a serious problem for a number of reasons. There's concerns about fairness, that these algorithmic decision-making systems, they encode bias in the data. Our bias is data. Our data is biased. They learn that bias, but then they spit out what seem like objective measures. So we're not even sensitized often in to the ways that they're biased. There's also different kinds of privacy concerns that arise with these technologies than with typical technologies. On the basis of what seems like pretty mundane data, they can make really invasive inferences about us. So we have to rethink what privacy is and how to respect privacy in the face of these big data analytics tools. There's problems of transparency. We can't always understand exactly, not for reasons of like patents or copyrights, but we really can't figure out how these systems make the decisions they're making. So how do we figure out what's going on inside them? And does it matter when we can't? That's just three: transparency, privacy, and fairness. There are many more. One of the things I often say is that like, we just don't yet have an ethics ecosystem or an ethics infrastructure for managing these problems. We're trying to build them, but the technology is moving really fast.
Whose job is it to build that ethical ecosystem to make those qualities, the transparency and privacy, front and center?
Yeah, one of the challenges is that the answer is all of us. We need sensitive regulation, because that's going to motivate a lot of people to take this seriously. But as in all areas, regulation is just one piece of managing ethics. Like, compliance is sort of the floor for ethics. And then there's, what else can we do? We need companies to better understand the ethical problems. We need ethicists like me to understand the technologies better, so that when we, so we don't just trot out old solutions that are really useful for technologies that we in the past, but they're not useful in this context. Like, privacy protections that we developed for traditional technologies or for medical records are not as useful in the context of big data analytics. So there's as a distributed responsibility, which is another one of the problems, because it's much easier to turn out technologies that do very cool things, but also have really bad consequences, than it is to build this infrastructure.
Can you give us a, for instance, of how big data is being used and then plugged into algorithms, for better or worse, in ways that might affect us?
Yeah, I think the most famous example is probably the Compass recidivism prediction tool. This is a tool that is trained on lots of data and provides risk scores for people it's been used for pretrial detention. So determining whether a given individual should be held without bail or held prior to trial based on their risk score, based on past information that has been trained into the system. And so one of the things that people worry about, for good reason, is, do these systems disproportionately negatively impact Black arrestees? Do they get higher risk scores on average than white arrestees? And what does that mean for sort of issues of distributive and procedural fairness?
Talking to John Basil, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Northeastern University, looking at the ethics surrounding artificial intelligence and things that might look like it, algorithms that use big data to make decisions that affect us. We had a caller call in, John, who wanted to reference 2001, A Space Odyssey, famously an artificial intelligence gone awry a little bit. Like, how much of our thinking about this is shaped and maybe sent in the wrong direction by all the science fiction that we've had leading up to today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think sometimes it's misleading, but sometimes it really paints a picture that can help us sort of better conceptualize the ethical challenges. Now, the thing about Space Odyssey is it's made very clear to us that this thing is a villain. It's not so clear that it's sentient or conscious, but we know it's the bad guy. But I think they really do. I mean, most of the cases where we have these sci-fi issues about sentient AI, they really do force us to think about the key question, like, is it really sentient? Like, my favorite example is WALL-E. There's a Pixar movie, because you really feel a lot of sympathy for WALL-E, but is WALL-E sentient? Is WALL-E sad that he can't be with Eva? I think that's the name of the other robot. Mm-hmm. So, like, they really raise these questions, what philosophers would call epistemological questions, of how can we come to know that these things have an inner life, that they're conscious, that they're self-aware?
I want to talk about the garbage in, garbage out part of this. You mentioned how algorithms can reinforce our biases. Some of these machine learning things, as you mentioned, trawl the internet looking for examples for their reactions, their responses. There's a lot of horrible stuff on the internet. There's a lot of great stuff in the internet. There's a lot of fact and a lot of fiction on the internet. How do we make sure that our inputs, whether we're talking about an algorithm or a machine learning tool or a hypothetical sentient AI of the future, how do we control to make sure that the inputs it's getting are useful?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of computer scientists working on how to solve this problem. There's a lot of work already done being able to identify the ways in which, even when we try our best to keep the garbage out, it gets in. But I think one of the things we want to think about is the problem is not just about managing the data, because a lot of the data that's going to make for useful applications, we can't control. So we got to think of these things as a holistic process, that these are tools, that they integrate into socio-technical decision-making systems. And we can also think about how to mitigate the bias at the other end by making sure we keep humans as part of the process, by making sure they understand the tools they're using, so they recognize the ways in which they're biased, so they can respond in a way that sort of mitigates against the bias. So it's not just about keeping the garbage out, because if we have to keep all the garbage out, then we lose out on a lot of the benefits of the algorithms. Although sometimes we might think, no, you can only use pristine data. The problem is that even when the data is, when we try to keep the data really pristine, we end up with the same kinds of problems.
Now, you're looking at these cutting edge questions. Again, some of these are hypotheticals that aren't even here yet, from the lens of philosophy and traditions that go back literally thousands of years. Are you able to take what you look at in AI and bring it back and maybe talk to your students about the things they might be learning in their 101 classes and tie those together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's never been easier to explain why some of the fundamental issues in philosophy matter for practical things, because the promises that people in the AI space make often just are point us directly back at these thousand-year-old questions. So there's a lot to learn from the current context about sort of fundamental ideas. Or they motivate thinking about these deeper issues. But also we face a fun challenge the other way. It's a difficult challenge, but it's fun. Is like the tools we developed for 2,000 years. These, how do we apply them to these tools? And like, how do the nuances of, for example, artificial intelligence and machine learning make us rethink or make us adapt the tools we've been developing for other contexts? So yeah, my classrooms are full of talking about the near future, the far future, and how it connects with the distant past, at least within philosophy.
And briefly, what are you most interested in that near future horizon?
Yeah, in the near future, I'm mostly thinking currently about issues of governance. How do we build structures? How do we bring the right people in the room to sort of solve these problems across the system? So how do we build that ethics ecosystem to really take on these problems?
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy and associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He was with us today to discuss issues of morals and ethics around artificial intelligence and other cutting-edge computer technology. This after a Google engineer claimed that one of the tools that he works with had achieved some form of sentience. Google and most people in this line of work say probably not yet, but it raises a lot of interesting questions. Coming up after the news, a pediatrician explains what we need to know about the COVID vaccine for infants and kids under 5, hoping you'll join in with your questions and your decision-making process along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you used to play pinball as a kid, or maybe you still do as an adult? We're going to talk to a pinball fan and hear about some hotspots here in Wisconsin. Now, the FDA last week granted emergency authorization to Pfizer and Moderna's COVID vaccines for children under 5 years old, infants as young as 6 months old. It's been a long road with some hiccups along the way, but a study in May found that only a fifth of parents with kids under 5 are going to get them vaccinated as soon as they possibly can. We have a pediatrician and infectious disease expert here with us to answer your questions about the COVID vaccine for kids under 5, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent of a kid in this age group? Have you been eagerly waiting for the vaccine? Do you plan on getting that shot as soon as possible? Are you, like many people, in a wait-and-see moment? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Pediatric Infectious Disease Specialist at UW Health. Dr. Conway, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
It's been a long road to get to this vaccine for younger kids. Can you talk about why this took so much longer than the grown-up versions?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated process to really figure out, you know, exactly what the right thing to do is. And you know, I think when we always look at these vaccines, there's two sides to the coin. You know, is it safe and is it effective? And I think the biggest thing that needed to be figured out was understanding the side effects in the older individuals, and then figure out how do you mitigate those, how do you minimize them, and still give enough immune protection that you actually get effective protection against these things. And it took a little while to make sure we understood everything on the adult side. You know, as a pediatrician, I was sort of happy that adults were going to be the guinea pigs for a change. And we've really kind of worked out all the details and then been able to move these clinical trials forward.
And health-wise, kids are not just small adults. It's not just a matter of dividing by the number of their body weight and giving a smaller dose. What did we end up with for how these doses work?
Yeah, so for the Pfizer vaccine, we're actually going to be able to get away with 1/10 of the dose, but it's going to be given over 3 doses. So the adults and most other age groups, 2 doses seem to be enough to really prime the immune system. And I think people may remember back in February, March, Pfizer was originally starting to think that they might have enough data to submit, but it really didn't look like that very, very low dose was enough with 2 doses, and so they then continued those studies with a 3rd dose. Moderna's coming in with 1/4 of the adult dose, so 25 micrograms as opposed to 100 micrograms for the adult priming doses. And so with that little bit bigger dose, they're able to get away with 2 doses, at least preliminarily. Now, we still anticipate that there's going to be the possibility of boosters eventually, the way we've had to add them for older individuals, but right now, 3 doses at 1/10 the dose for Pfizer, 2 doses, 1/4 of the dose for Moderna.
One reason I think a lot of parents are giving for not jumping in right away is, well, wait, we've heard younger kids are the least vulnerable to COVID. Can you talk about the need, how much concern there is about these younger kids getting COVID, the impacts it can have on them?
Yeah, I think the first year of the pandemic, we kind of fooled ourselves. We were so good at mitigating and protecting the kids. I mean, we closed schools, everybody was masking, kids were in bubbles. And so I think that there was sort of a false narrative that kids just don't get this infection. As soon as we released them back into the wild of schools, even with masks, we saw a pretty rapid spread of the disease. And, you know, some of the estimates from CDC surmise that as many as 3 out of 4 kids may have had it. I think the other part, though, is that people don't see as many of the kids that we do that actually are suffering more severe consequences. So, you know, you're much more likely to die from COVID than you would be from influenza or something else that's a similar virus that circulates. But we've seen, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of kids that have gotten sick, and many, many of them ended up hospitalized. And now we're starting to see some of the sequelae. You know, we're seeing some of these kids now with long COVID. We're starting to see kids that have what seem to be permanent problems with their lungs and even neurologic issues. So I think that as more and more kids are getting infected, as the remaining vulnerable parts of the population, we're starting to learn that they are actually vulnerable to occasionally having bad outcomes. The other is that these viruses are unpredictable. They keep changing, and I think as they keep changing, they unfortunately do still present some potential threat as we move forward. And so I think that's the biggest reasons that we've argued that kids deserve the equal opportunity to be protected, just like their older siblings and parents.
Talking to Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist at UW Health, associate director for health sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison, looking at the newly approved COVID vaccines for kids under 5. You can join in if you have a question, a comment about that. You want to share your decision-making process if you're a parent of a kid in this age group? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, you mentioned safety and effectiveness. Let's start with effectiveness. What do we know about how much benefit these kids will get from these vaccines?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process because what was done is really what we call bridging studies, where they've looked at the immunogenicity, you know, basically how much antibody kids have developed, and looked at basically how much antibody the adults develop. And essentially, we're shooting for a dose that gave that kind of similar immune response. Then you kind of see how people do once you've gone back out into society. And so that they've shown that these are moderately protective against getting any infection. So I think everybody's now familiar with the term breakthrough infection. And so we do see that these kids can still get infected, although much less than those that are unvaccinated. But what we haven't seen is any of these kids that have been immunized getting hospitalized, ending up in the ICU, or any of the severe consequences. And I think that's really where we're primarily directing our attention with all of these vaccines now, is they're really designed to protect against the most severe outcomes. If they also protect against any infection, great, but they're never going to be 100%.
With the different variants, the latest Omicrons going around, how much of that moving target problem for vaccines, whether we're talking for kids or grownups?
Yeah, I think it's a major problem. And I think that we've, you know, currently temporized things by continuing to add booster doses using the original strain, get people's immunity up enough that it actually can protect them against some of these newer strains. But ultimately, really what we need is more focused vaccines directed against the actual pathogens that are circulating right now. You know, we've gotten very good at it with influenza, where we update the vaccines every year and change the strains, and we're going to have to do the exact same thing. We're starting to see now many of the companies working on these Omicron-specific boosters that are directed against those newer strains. And I think that's really where we're going to need to go, is the ability to quickly modify the vaccines. And the regulatory folks are going to have to figure out, how do you actually make sure, again, that they're going to be safe and work the way they're supposed to, and at the same time update them as necessary.
All right, so that's effectiveness. Now, safety. Can you talk about the safety testing that went into these vaccines for kids?
Yeah, these were multi-center trials, so these were done all over the place. You know, the FDA made a clear edict early on in the pandemic, which I think was really a positive thing, that we really needed to approximate what the rest of the population looked like. You know, we can't continue to do things the way we used to and test them in healthy white males and then eventually get to other populations. So we've been very inclusive in making sure that we had a good idea about how these acted in all portions of the population. And what we've seen at those very low doses of the Pfizer vaccine, really very minimal side effects. Moderna's got a little bit more, as you would expect, with a little bit higher dose. So about a fifth of the kids end up with some fever. Most of the kids will complain a little bit that it hurts at the injection site. They don't complain nearly as much as the adults do because they're used to getting these kinds of things. But it really very little in the way of other complaints. Occasional, you know, aches and a couple of kids complaining of headaches, but really nothing significant at these very low doses.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Madison. Joe, hi. Joe, are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess the question I had, or comment, I was listening to NPR this morning, and they had a doctor from Yale and another gentleman, and I'm sorry, I don't remember where he was from, but they were discussing this exact same topic, and the one doctor made the comment, he said that like 95-96% of the people that were infected with COVID this year were over the age of 40. And he said when it came down to the younger kids, it was like less than a tenth of a percent that were actually hospitalized. And I know the pediatrician just said before that all the kids that were hospitalized. So I guess what is correct? I mean, he was saying it was the... Yes, kids were getting infected, especially when they went back to school, but it seemed like a lot of them had very minimal side effect and were not hospitalized.
I gotcha. Joe, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Cowan, let me try this out and see if I'm understanding you correctly. Joe's point is right. If we compare the impact on adults of COVID versus the impact to kids, the adults are getting it worse. So they're more likely to be hospitalized. But if we look at the younger kids and say how they're affected by COVID versus how they're affected by, say, influenza, COVID for them is way more dangerous. It's going to put more kids in the hospital than a lot of the other diseases we're familiar with. That did I hear you right? Is that about right?
Yeah, no, you're both right on the nose. And Joe, you know, it's absolutely correct that you know, this is a disease that is certainly more devastating the older you are, or the worse your immune system is. And so kids are fortunately younger, healthier, and in general have better immune systems. I think one of the things we have to recognize is there's a pretty large population of kids that actually don't fit that paradigm, that actually do have underlying medical conditions, and those are the kids that, you know, largely suffer the worst. But again, these things are unpredictable. You know, of the 400 plus kids that have died from this, you know, more than half of them were totally normal, healthy kids. And so I think that's the thing, that, you know, if it's your kid or if it's your family that's affected, you know, you don't want anybody else to ever have to deal with this. And so that's the sort of, I think, spurious logic, is just because it's not as devastating doesn't mean that it's not still devastating to some portion of the population. And again, you know, countless thousands, if not millions, of parents have been clamoring to be able to feel comfortable that their kids can go out, lead a much more normal life, get back in with their regular friends and family, and be comfortable that those kids are really going to be at minimal risk for having any of these unfortunate and all the rare, not unexpected negative consequences.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling in. We are talking to pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. James Conway from UW-Madison, looking at the newly approved COVID vaccine for young kids and infants, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you making that appointment for your kid now that these are available? Have you already gotten that shot for your kid? Or are you watching and waiting if you're a parent of kids in this younger age group? If you work in healthcare, I'd love to hear what you are seeing. Are you getting people breaking down the door to get these shots? Or are you surprised at how slow it is? And in general, what questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW Health pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. James Conway about the COVID vaccine for young kids and infants. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Dr. Conway about these vaccines, how they work, the decision of how and when to get them? Are you a parent in this position? Do you have the appointment already, or is there something else you still want to know? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We had a call from Vicky who couldn't stay on the line, Dr. Conway. She's wondering about kids who, you know, usually maybe in those first couple few years, they're getting exposed to lots of illnesses. Their immune system is building up. Now, maybe for a lot of them, they didn't get that exposure. She's just wondering about, you know, how to take care of them, how that's going to affect their health and their risk from diseases, COVID or otherwise.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's been really tricky. We've seen outbreaks of diseases in really off-season times that we didn't expect. We had a respiratory syncytial virus outbreak last August, as you know, we just got gradually back into the beginnings of some normalcy. So we do expect that we're going to see a resurgence. We're seeing parainfluenza 3 and adenovirus currently circulating in the region. Again, not things that we usually see when we get into summer. Those are usually kind of winter months and fall. But this is going to be kind of the unpredictability of how things work. And so, you know, I think one of the things we're all learning is that we do need to be a little bit more responsible when we're sick. I think we're certainly getting employers that are more willing to actually let people truly call in sick when they have illness. And I think we're going to ask people to do that more often. You know, I think COVID may end up kind of fading into the background and just circulating continuously at some point. And so I think then it's going to be just one of the litany of viruses that knock people out and, you know, really do spread through communities. And so figuring out how we manage that all together and how often people can, you know, sort of take advantage of the ability to kind of pull themselves out of either social events or work events, I think is going to be really important. I think parents are really going to, you know, as much as it's inconvenient, have to really think about trying to keep their kids home when they're sick if they really want schools to continue to stay open and function as we'd like them to do.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Brett is with us in Middleton. Brett, hi.
Yeah, hey, good afternoon. Just a quick question. I have a four-year-old son that recently had COVID about 4 to 6 weeks ago. And my question was, what's the recommendation for getting the vaccination, or is there a period of natural immunization provided by COVID? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, Brett. And I think there's two pieces of that. You know, one, we certainly do ask people if your kid or if you are actively ill, just to try to avoid exposing the healthcare workers as well as the other folks at the offices that are giving the vaccines. So we certainly ask people to wait that full 10 days, plus make sure that all their symptoms are gone. As far as then the timing of when it's okay to get vaccinated, there's really no downside to getting vaccinated at any point then after that infection. And in fact, you know, we do anticipate that there's quite a few kids that are out there that have been infected already. And so these vaccines actually, while they may not be quite as robust an immune response as we see in adults with these lower doses, essentially these may end up acting as boosters for these kids to give them even more robust immunity than the vaccine trial showed. So I actually really encourage people whose kids have had COVID, and again, many of them have even without having been detected, that they are still going to benefit from getting vaccinated to give them sort of that much more increased immunity, especially as these variants keep changing and the immunity from the original infections doesn't seem to hold up as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brad, at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the doctor has seen any risk-benefit studies for these COVID shots for young children. My understanding is that in many countries, possibly this one also, that there's not been a healthy young child who died of COVID. And yet we see all this myocarditis, which is not a minor thing. It's about 25 or 30% of people diagnosed with myocarditis die within 6.5 years.
Jim, thanks for the call, Dr. Conway.
Yeah, a couple ways to look at that. You know, first of all, you know, with the concerns of either clots or myocarditis that we're seeing, you know, very, very rarely in vaccine recipients in the adult world, you know, we know that the risk of actually getting myocarditis from COVID infection itself is somewhere between 20 and 50 times greater than it is from the vaccine. Similar to blood clots, these viruses, as they infect people, really do knock their immune system into, you know, almost a chaotic maelstrom. And so they really do trigger clotting in people. And so the risks have really been, you know, sorted out very nicely, that the risks from the vaccines are extraordinarily low compared to the risk of the actual disease itself. I would also have to dispute what you sort of mentioned, that we've actually seen, you know, well over 400 healthy kids die from COVID here in the United States alone, where that was attributed as the cause of death. We've also seen a lot of kids die that had other complications that had underlying medical conditions, and COVID sort of set things off. So I think we really need to dispel this myth that COVID is not a big deal for kids. It certainly is unusual to have bad outcomes, but if you're kids, they don't want to have any of these outcomes if they can avoid them. The other piece of it, I think, in the cost benefit that people need to think about is that if we diminish the risk of infection and diminish the risk of ongoing transmission and shedding of virus, we actually make it that much more functional for people to continue to function in sports and schools and all those kinds of things, rather than have to get into a setting where you're going to actually have to close things down when you have outbreaks. And so I think there's additional, what we call indirect benefit, that really does need to be factored in when we make these kind of decisions.
Jim, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Dr. James Conway from UW Health, looking at COVID vaccines for kids under five. Still time for you to call in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, I've seen some people kind of try to figure out the timing here. You mentioned earlier that there's work on variant-specific vaccines, ones that try to keep up. So people wondering, whether it's for their kids or for themselves, should I get a vaccine now or hang on for a while, wait and see if I can get a more targeted vaccine to current variants? What do you say to them?
Well, for kids, I think these Omicron variant-specific vaccines are going to be quite some time. You know, we've just gotten into the emergency use authorization approvals. They're still going to have to go through, you know, ongoing monitoring and larger data collection before they're going to be able to get to the point of a full biological license being issued. Then only will they start to then look at variant vaccines for the kids. So I think for kids, you know, something's better than nothing, and what we've got right now is really what you're going to be able to get your hands on and use. And I do think it's important to think about this, especially as we get to back to school time. For adults, you know, I think more is better, and so I think that currently getting a booster, if you're in the age groups or in the medical conditions where they're recommended, I think getting one now is certainly prudent, especially as we see the Omicron BA4 and BA5 starting to really pick up quite quickly over these last couple of weeks. And then I think we'll have to sort of, you know, time will tell whether we're going to get into a further booster later in the year. I won't be surprised, but those booster variant vaccines are really just starting to kind of come to fruition at the end of their trials. So it's still going to be some time. So if you're in a group that, you know, everybody basically five and above is recommended to get a booster, and then everybody over 50 is recommended to get a second booster, and everybody with an underlying immunodeficiency. So wherever you are in that booster scheme, you really do need to make sure you get one as soon as you can.
In our last couple of minutes, big picture, we are in a lower level of cases in the U.S. than we have been in the not too distant past. Deaths and hospitalizations seem to be down. We've been here before. It sometimes comes back. What are you watching for next in the progress of this disease and in the effort to stop it?
Yeah, I think we're really looking at these mutants, these variants as they come out, to see how they continue to change, both how transmissible they are, but also how good the immunity holds up from either prior infection or prior infections and vaccines. And so I think those are the big things that we're really watching at this point. You know, I think we are starting to see again that there's fading or waning of immunity from those original vaccine series. And so we're starting to see more and more people essentially become vulnerable as that immunity fades. And so we're starting to see picking up, at least in some areas, some of these outbreaks with these variant strains. So I think that that's going to be the big thing that we watch. I think we're very encouraged by these variant-specific vaccine boosters that are coming along. I think those are going to really be a game changer when we get to that point, hopefully later this fall. But I think those are the big things that we're watching. I think the other big thing, and there's now good surveillance globally, is do we get a brand new Greek letter that pops up at some point? You know, we kind of made it through most of the Greek alphabet and then kind of got stuck at Omicron. but there's still more letters to be had, and they've actually already discussed what the further naming is going to be when we run out of Greek letters. But we do anticipate that at some point new mutants are going to show up, and then it's going to be a matter of what those do and where do they spread. Certainly society and travel has gotten back to much more close to what used to be the normal. And so I think, unfortunately, we're a little bit worried that if something does emerge, it'll spread a lot more quickly than it did earlier in the pandemic.
Dr. Conway, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. James Conway, Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison and a pediatric infectious disease specialist at UW-Health. He joined us for a look at the under-5 COVID vaccine now available. You can still share your story if you're a parent of kids in this age group. Have you been eagerly waiting for this? Do you have your appointment? Let us know what's going on. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's the 50th anniversary of Title IX, a federal effort to guarantee equal access to education for girls and women. We'll find out how it affected schools and sports tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. It finally happened. After years in the making, a Big Ten university has successfully registered a trademark for the. Yes, the word the. Now, who would do such a thing? It's Ohio State. Oh, I'm sorry. It's the Ohio State University. This all started a few years back. I mentioned it on the show at the time. Ohio State filed for a trademark for the use of the word the on clothing. It was rejected then for complicated law reasons. Long story short, they got it sorted out, and a court awarded them the trademark this week. What does this mean for you? I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure we can all keep using the word the in conversation and in writing. But if you want to make and sell a baseball cap with the word the on it, I'd get some legal advice first. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network with the.